Hello, I'm John McNamara, the information architect for Web3MQ, and I'm sat here today with Andy Banks. Hello, Andy.
Hello.
Hi. So we're going to talk today a little bit about Web3MQ and clustering, and we're going to aim at the novice and new user. So we're going to have a wee talk about the high-level clustering concepts, what the user kind of needs to know before they start implementing clustering, what that kind of means in MQ, and we'll run through a very quick high-level scenario of a setup. And Andy will hopefully give us some nice hints and tips. So, Andy, the very first question I'd ask is, in terms of Web3MQ clustering, what is it exactly?
What does it do?
Yeah, what does it do?
Yeah, okay. So it does three things for you. The first thing it does is get you some level of high availability.
Right.
The second thing it does is allow you to spread an app out across more than one queue manager.
Yep.
And the third thing it does is it keeps track of a load of queue and channel definitions for you that you need in more than one place. So normally when you set up a non-clustered channel, you have to define bits of it at both ends. When you do the clustered kind of channel, you get to do half the job because you only need to do it at one end.
So
it makes life easier for you.
So I see what you're saying. So if I was doing kind of a point-to-point connection, I create two queue managers, and what you're saying there is I need to create a sender queue potentially and the receiver end for the other queue manager, join them together, but with the clustering that job is made a lot simpler.
Yeah, there's just less to do.
That's fantastic. Grand. Okay, brilliant. So what are the benefits of having a cluster for MQ?
Okay, so having got your definitions done and some messages flowing, there's two benefits you're going to get after that, and they stem from the fact that when you send a message in this cluster, if you do it right, there's usually more than one place it can go to, more than one queue it can end up on.
Right.
And that gives you two benefits. First of all, you're not limited to the capacity of a single queue manager anymore, because you can keep adding more queue managers to do the processing of versions of that queue. The second thing it gets you is, of course, if one of the versions of that queue and its application and the hardware it's running on collapses and dies in some way, shape or form, then all of the others are still going and still processing the messages that are sent to them. And the cluster's smart enough to spot the fact that it's gone, and it won't queue up new messages for it if it can go to the other places. And so the service you're running keeps going on the remaining hardware.
Okay, I'm with you. Are there any kind of considerations when doing that in terms of, say, message sequencing, for example?
Yeah, there certainly are. So if it's important to you that all of the messages for a particular application go to the same place, you can say so when your application that's doing the putting opens up the queue. There's a parameter which by default says bind on open, which means send them all to the same place. But the better thing to do is to override that and say bind not fixed, and then that will spray the messages around and fail over if need be. So the downside to fixing where the messages go, of course, is once you've made your choice, you're stuck with it. If it then fails, we've made the promise to send them all to the same place, so they will in fact queue up and wait for that system to come back to get processed.
Fair play. Awesome. That's a great overview of kind of clustering, what it can give you, and the things to consider. So if I was a new user and I was thinking about clustering for the first time, and I was thinking about planning, what sort of things would I have to keep in mind?
Well, actually, the first thing you can do, even before the planning, is set up a couple of queue managers on your box and have a go.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I like it.
That's probably the best way to learn about it. And in the Explorer, there's a little wizard to help you set it up.
Yeah.
And that is a good way to find out about it. In terms of planning, there's a few details you need to take into account. So obviously the first thing you need to think about is what you're trying to achieve, how many messages you want to process on which queues in how many places. In other words, you've got to make some kind of capacity decisions. How many back-end processors do you really need? How much availability do you really need? And so on and so forth. Usually that's fairly obvious to people to when they start up.
Yep.
Within that, inside a cluster, there are usually two machines that have a special role, and they're called the four repositories. And you have to nominate which two machines those are going to be. And we say have two of them because it's important that at least one of them keeps going all the time.
Right.
And that's the reason for having two. They're the machines that are going to remember where everything is. So that's why they're particularly important. And those two machines you want to make sure are reasonably well looked after, aren't going to die and be on some fragile part of the network or on, you know, a laptop that someone's going to take home at night.
Fair enough, yeah.
So the big decision about those is they need to be on some not particularly powerful hardware, but on some reasonably reliable, well-looked-after hardware that's going to be available when you need it.
Fair enough.
And that's probably the most crucial thing you've got to decide.
And the repositories there, Andy, what do they do? They store all the topology information of that cluster?
More or less. Whenever you define a clustered queue or a clustered topic or put a new queue manager into a cluster, those two machines are told about it, and they in their turn tell all of the other machines that need to know what's going on. Uh-huh. And any time anything changes, they're the first to know, basically.
Grand. Okay, so yeah, I can see where they should be well looked after in that case. So fair enough. That's brilliant. So we've spoken a bit about what clustering is. We've spoken a little about the important topics when you can start planning your cluster and some of the salient points of the cluster itself. So say, for example, then I was familiar with point-to-point. I knew and understood how to set up a queue manager, a queue, and then link that to another queue manager via, say, a send-receive channel. If, say, I wanted to set up a cluster between, say, three queue managers, what's the kind of process that I would kind of follow to do that?
Okay, well, the first thing to bear in mind is what the clustering is really doing is automating that process you've done manually.
Right.
And it's going to, because it's automated, it's going to eliminate some finger trouble, like spelling the channel differently at both ends. So, you know, if there's one thing it won't do, it's it's make spelling mistakes.
Fair play.
So, I guess we've been through some of it, but the first thing you need to do is decide on the name of your cluster.
Okay.
Isn't that difficult? Think of a name.
Yeah.
And
I guess that's got to be a unique name, has it, I suppose?
Thinking of a unique name isn't that difficult, but it needs to be the same name everywhere. That's what says this is the one cluster, because it's all spelt the same way everywhere.
Okay.
And then you need to figure out which two machines are going to be these full repositories, and you do alter queue manager to make them the full repository for that named cluster.
Right.
And then you start defining cluster receiver channels, one on each queue manager, and it's like an ordinary receiver channel but with a cluster name attached to it.
Oh.
And the odd thing about it is that it's got the DNS name of that queue manager as part of the definition. So even though it's receiving inbound connects, that's what it's there for, it's got the its own address as part of the definition, and the reason for that is because it's going to tell all of the other queue managers how to connect to it.
Right, I see.
And then, to kind of bootstrap the process, you need to go to the other queue managers and type in or define one sender channel. You only need to do one once for one of the two full repositories.
Oh.
So the two full repositories will point at each other, and all of the other queue managers will point at one or other of them, and that just introduces them to the cluster and lets them join in and build up the full set of definitions.
Oh, fair play. So that sounds pretty straightforward. Now, I understand as well as providing a level of high availability and scalability, that it can clustering can also be used for kind of more of a point-to-point basis, but with kind of reduced admin. So I'm guessing that's when you refer to the limited number of definitions you've got to create, is that kind of what you mean?
What we didn't talk about just was putting a queue into the mix. So let's say you've got some application, and we'll pick the usual one, payroll.
Yeah.
So what you do is you define yourself a queue called payroll, and you put this cluster attribute on it, and you fire up your app doing payroll processing, and you say do that on one or more of your queue managers. But having done just that, you can now send these payroll messages from anywhere in the cluster, because anyone who opens any application that now opens up that queue to put payroll messages will go and ask the cluster where the payroll queue actually is, and it may get one or two or three or however many queues in existence, and it will make a workload choice about where to send a particular payroll message, and off it will go down the channels to that payroll queue. And then the payroll app that's processing those messages, if it wants to send a message back to the application sitting on some other queue manager, all it does is the regular deal, sends the reply to queue and the reply to queue manager, and because that queue manager is also in the cluster, we know which channels to send it down to get it back to the right application without doing any extra work.
Wow, that sounds really impressive. So when you define the queue to a cluster, do you need any special parameters to tell the cluster this is going to be a clustered queue as opposed to a normal...
There is just one parameter, and it's the cluster name. So you say cluster and then the name, and that's it. That's the basics. The only other parameter you might want to think about is there is this defbind parameter, and that is going to say when an application opens this queue, is it going to lock onto it, or is it going to float around amongst all of the versions of this queue and spray its messages around?
Right.
As I say, the default is you'll lock onto the queue. That's the bind on open version of that parameter. But if you want the most powerful version of workload balancing, then you'll change the default to be bind not fixed.
Okay, fair. And that gives you kind of the more rugged HA capability for a cluster, is it?
It gives you, it'll switch on two things. It'll mean that at any point while you've got the queue open, if that version fails, we'll stop using it and send the messages somewhere else.
Right.
And it'll also mean you get the power of all of the machines that host the queue to do the message processing.
Ah, I see. Okay, fair play. That sounds awesome. Okay, so Andy, that sounds fantastic. We're talking at a high level what clustering is. We've spoken a bit more at a granular level of how clustering is implemented in MQ and what the user needs to think about in order to plan for it. And we've kind of gone through a very small, very simple scenario, and we've spoken about the reduced admin benefit of a cluster, and the scalability and the high availability aspects of the cluster as well. So would you have a single tip for somebody who was starting out for the first time creating a cluster? Is there one thing to keep in mind, Andy?
Well, several things, but I'd say top of my list is keep it simple, the obvious one.
Right.
I've seen a number of people start out with this stuff, and there's a bit of a temptation to get carried away and start defining lots and lots of little clusters that overlap, because you can do some very complicated things with clustering, but more often than not you don't need to. And so popping everything into one cluster is a good starting point for thinking about how to set this stuff up. And don't be afraid of making those clusters big, because you can put an awful lot of queue managers in a cluster. We've seen people put thousands of queue managers into clusters.
Wow.
And you really don't need to break them down into smaller clusters until you get, you know, into the thousands. So yeah, that would be my number one tip. Don't make life complicated.
Fair play. That's a great piece of advice in life in general, I think.
Yeah, we don't like it.
So in that case, Andy, so we've got a tip, and so let's say now we've got our cluster set up and we're running with it, and something goes wrong, and I'm looking, oh my god, we're not getting messages distributed in the way that we feel we should. Have you got any sort of tips for troubleshooting the cluster?
Yeah, don't panic.
Thank you very much, Andy.
Tip number one.
Yeah.
So quite often there's only really one thing you can get wrong when you're setting up a cluster. Let's assume you're at the stage where you're setting it up and it doesn't spring into life. More often than not, it's because you've spelt a network address or made some kind of typo type error like that, and your channel hasn't started and whatever. So before you go hacking away at too many things and typing commands like refresh cluster to try and kick it into life, it's worth double checking those definitions to make sure that, you know, you've got the right port numbers and the right DNS address, and go at it like that. If having got all of this stuff to work, you start to see that messages have stopped flowing, the thing to do now is to go around and check which channels are running, and just be fairly methodical about it. Just go to the queue manager where you've put the messages, see if the messages are building up on the cluster transmit queue, see if the channels are running there. If they are, fine, then move on to the machine where you're expecting the messages to turn up, see if the channels are running there, and so on and so forth. There's actually not a lot of magic to it. It's basically making sure that the plumbing has actually got messages flowing through it and they're not piling up somewhere.
Fair play.
The other way to go about diagnosing problems is the regular MQSC or Explorer commands, to actually list the contents of the cluster and make sure that everything you think should be there is in fact there. So there's a couple of basic commands. There's a display queue or display queue plus command, which when you type it in, you should see all of the versions of the queue in that cluster. And if you type display plus queue manager, you should see effectively all of those cluster receiver channels you've defined in the cluster, and you know, you can start to look for if there's a problem that messages aren't getting to a particular queue manager. It should be in that list, and if it isn't, you can start to examine why it isn't, and which bit of comms is broken perhaps, or which definition is wrong. And that's about it.
That's fantastic, Andy. Thank you very much. That was really, really instructive and absolutely bang on 20 minutes. Thank you very much. Really much appreciated. Thank you. And thanks for listening.